or the whole judicial apparatus is being misused to oppress the opposition in Western countries, and Germany, of course, as well. Our little party, what happens to us is crazy. So we have a situation where the European people have no means left to liberate themselves. All these rulers are externally and internally going forward illegally, and that is a very, very bad situation. And I don't see any close positive viewpoint on this, and I am very much fearing escalation.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Christoph Forstall in Berlin, Germany, Rick Sterling in Walnut Creek, California. And thank you. See you next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here, we enlighten you with the Ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وما تكون في شأن وما تتلو وما تتلو منه من قرآن ولا تعملون من عمل إلا كنا عليكم شهودا وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Qur'an, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater, but it is in a clear book.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
President Raisi says strengthening Iran's strategic depth was a major goal of his trip to three African countries, during which 21 cooperation agreements were signed. Ukraine receives the US cluster munitions a week after Washington pledged to supply Kiev with such weapons despite growing international condemnation. Also coming up, North Korea strongly defends its recent ballistic missile launch at the UN Security Council, saying it was exercising its right to self-defense.
Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us.
Our top story, President Ibrahim Raisi says strengthening Iran's strategic depth was among the main goals of his tour of three African nations. He made the remarks upon arrival in the Iranian capital at the end of his visits to Kenya, Uganda, and Zimbabwe. Raisi described Africa as a land of opportunities which must not be neglected. He added that Africa also abounds with natural resources, mines, and countless potentialities. Raisi said an agreement reached on bartering petrochemical products with basic goods was a major achievement of his trip. During Raisi's trip, Iran signed a total of 21 cooperation agreements with the three African nations. On the last leg of his tour, Raisi said Iran has developed good relations with African countries since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Tehran says boosting ties with Africa is high on its policy agenda. And Iran's foreign minister, who's accompanying President Raisi's delegation, says that Tehran seeks a win-win cooperation with Africa. He says Iran wants to transfer technology to the Black Continent and empower its people.
Today, several countries, including the United States, China, Turkey, and India, have made investments in Africa and engaged in serious cooperation in various fields. This shows that Africa today is different from Africa in the past. African countries are now not targeted for mine extraction activities only. Iran's view on Africa is quite different from that of neocolonialism or its older version. We seek to transfer technology to Africa and empower the continent. African leaders and their people are now quite sensitive on protecting their independence. This is among commonalities between Iran and African nations. Another issue of equal importance for Iran and Africa is the U.S. sanctions regime. With Africa's assistance, we should prevent the U.S. and certain states that still have a colonial mindset from utilizing the deadly tool of sanctions against nations.
Elsewhere, a senior Pentagon official says Ukraine has received the U.S. cluster munitions a week after Washington pledged to supply Kiev with such weapons. A Ukrainian military official confirmed the announcement. Kiev says it will use the munitions in its counteroffensive against Russia. Moscow has warned of countermeasures if Ukraine uses cluster bombs against Russian troops. The U.S. decision to send the munitions to Ukraine has drawn international criticism, even from Washington's European allies. Cluster munitions are banned in more than 100 countries as they release a large number of bomblets and indiscriminately kill a large number of people over a wide area. Scott Ritter, a former U.S. Marine intelligence officer, believes the cluster munitions the U.S. is providing for Ukraine will have no significant impact on the ongoing fighting.
The United States, together with its European allies, has committed to provide Ukraine with the resources necessary to support a counteroffensive, but they've not lived up to their promises. Ukraine currently is firing around 7,000 artillery rounds a day. Ukraine believes that this is one quarter the amount of artillery rounds they should be firing based upon their capacity in terms of number of tubes, but they simply don't have the ammunition. The United States has agreed to release its war reserve stocks of the M864 dual-purpose improved conventional munitions, basically 155-millimeter artillery shells equipped with cluster bomblets. These weapons are designed to break up large formations of armored vehicles, infantry in the open. The last place that they're going to be have any utility is against a fortified defensive position with overhead coverage on earth softened by rain, etc. These weapons will actually make Ukraine weaker for two reasons. One, there'll be less impact than a conventional high explosive round. They'll have less destructive impact on the Russians. And two, they're going to prompt a Russian countermeasure, which is going to be in the form of improved cluster munitions used by the Russians. The Russians currently have a tenfold superiority in artillery over the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians are about to find themselves saturated with cluster bomb units. It's going to result in higher casualty rates on the part of the Ukrainians and less efficiency on the battlefield. A counteroffensive that's already failed will only fail even further.
Turning elsewhere now, the latest inflation figures from the United States show a country still suffering the backlash of a failed sanctions campaign against Russia. The official inflation rate eased thanks to low energy prices, but a deeper dive into the numbers reveals widespread hardship. Ramima Zahari reports from Chicago.
Gas prices that are 30% lower than a year ago caused headline inflation in the United States to drop to 3%, the lowest rate since March 2021. However, core inflation, overall prices excluding energy and food, remains at 5%, a pace not seen for 40 years. The continuing record inflation goes beyond daily bread and to long-term needs like healthcare prices, empty retirement funds, and, especially for young adults, unaffordable housing.
Back when I started looking for a house about 10 years ago, it was actually kind of in my budget, even with what I was making back then. But today, I make a little bit more, but I would say the housing has increased, like, exponentially, so it's completely out of the question to almost even look at a house right now.
Economics literacy is famously low in the United States. There is almost no media discussion of government coming to the rescue by imposing price caps, limits on corporate profits, or punishment for price gouging. Many in the U.S. can only conceive of government as an oppressive force which taxes much and gives little in return.
I don't know what the government needs to do, but I think they have their fingers in too much, and I do think it's going to get worse. I have raised my prices to keep up with the increased cost in ingredients.
I'm not sure what they can do or what they should do, but let's hope so. Gas, for one, bring that down. Too many taxes across the board, for my opinion.
There is a growing chorus regarding the destructive role played by the globalist form of liberal capitalism, which has gutted domestic capabilities and sovereignty for the past 40 years, even within the United States.
Getting parts and stuff and getting things shipped over here from everywhere, we need to bring things back into America, stop having all these businesses go everywhere else. We need to bring everything back here and get things going again and stop buying from all these countries. Let's try to buy from the United States. All our industrial, you know, all our metal and everything else comes from over. Well, we send it over there and we get it back and we pay a bunch of money to get it back. So
the end of coronavirus stimulus has crushed household savings, led to record credit card debt, and wage growth outpaced the inflation rate this month for the first time in 27 months. Even when inflation does get down to the 2% target rate, that doesn't mean significant damage hasn't already been done to the working class. The 2% target rate isn't expected to be reached until 2025 at the earliest, and that's without any global surprises. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Now, Hollywood actors have joined writers in an ongoing strike to demand increase in pay and better working conditions. Some 160,000 performers stopped work on Thursday night after negotiations with studios failed. The union, known as the Screen Actors Guild, American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, also demands assurances that their work will not be replaced by artificial intelligence. The strike by screenwriters started in May. A double strike by actors and writers is unprecedented since the 1960s. The work stoppage is expected to escalate economic damage to studios and further disrupt scores of American shows and movies. North Korea's recent ballistic missile launch was in line with its right to self-defense and was aimed at boosting its deterrence power.
Our test fire of a new type of ICBM, Hwasongpo 18, is it warranted exercise of the right to self-defense, to deter dangerous military moves of hostile forces, and safeguard security of our state and peace in the region without a fail?
The North Korean ambassador to the UN was addressing a Security Council meeting to discuss Pyongyang's missile tests conducted a day earlier. He said North Korea's test firing of the ICBM posed no security threats to its neighbors. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un personally oversaw the missile test. It was launched amid the heightened tensions on the Korean Peninsula. On Monday, Pyongyang said a U.S. spy plane has violated its airspace. It also denounced Washington's plan to deploy a nuclear submarine near the Korean Peninsula. Tens of thousands of junior doctors across England are on a five-day strike in what's been described as the longest single walkout by doctors in the history of the country's National Health Service. The strike, the fourth of its kind in the past year, comes after talks between the government and the union representing the doctors over pay and working conditions broke down. Saeed Poreza brings us up to speed.
A familiar sight as the summer of strikes and disruptions in England rolls on. While some health workers have settled, junior doctors, who form 40% of the workforce in the National Health Service here, are still locked in a bitter war of words with the government. They say the request of a 35% pay rise is an opening offer and accuse the government of negotiating in bad faith.
They need to get around the negotiating table and make junior doctors a reasonable offer. I think that what we're asking for is fair. We're asking for pay restoration. Our profession's pay has been eroded. It hasn't kept up with inflation. and we deserve to be paid for our skills.
And while the deadlock continues, it's the patients who are paying the price, as hundreds of thousands of appointments and operations are postponed, despite Prime Minister Rishi Sunak setting cutting the NHS waiting list, now at more than 7 million, as a top priority.
The government argues that any pay rises funded through borrowing for these junior doctors or others in the public sector risk fueling the inflation that's highest among the G7 advanced economies. But not everyone agrees with that.
The cause of inflation is not the workers asking for wage rises. It's the printing of money. You see, central banks want to blame everybody but themselves. They printed the money. The US did it, the UK did it, the Europeans did it.
As the strike got underway, an announcement by the Prime Minister saying his government's offer for pay rises was the last such offer and that there would be no more negotiations with the unions. But with the tens of thousands of nurses and doctors having quit last year, the strikers say the pay rises are needed to keep them in the profession.
People are leaving the profession and we're losing staff. They're going across to Australia, New Zealand, America to get paid more money. But also within the UK, they're taking on more private work, equivalent private work.
This month, we'll also see disruption under rails as an overtime ban for train drivers comes into force and as staff walk off altogether yet again. For the time being, disputes dragging on, plenty of problems for the government, few simple solutions. Saidpur is up, London.
Elsewhere, a conference to honor the victims of a brutal chemical attack in the city of Sardesht has been held with the presence of a Japanese diplomatic delegation. The purpose of this conference was to raise the voice of the people of Sardesht as the first victims of a chemical attack in the world. Farzana Shuryan has more.
A common wound among the Iranian and Japanese nation. Following the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Sardasht became the third city to endure an attack by a weapon of mass destruction. Sardasht, the first city to suffer a chemical attack, hosted a Japanese diplomatic delegation to commemorate the victims of this assault. According to Shiva, the wife of one of the victims of Sardasht, her husband is still suffering from the consequence of the attack that occurred 36 years ago.
Because of the sanctions, I can't get the appropriate medicine for my husband. He has been suffering from chemo for a long time.
36 years ago, Western countries, including the United States, England, and Germany, provided Iraqi dictator Saddam chemical weapons, which he used on Iranian people. This action has not been condemned by any human rights body in the world.
The crime that occurred in Sardasht was a clear example of genocide. However, to this day, no one has accused the governments responsible for these horrible crimes.
Mr. Murakami from the Japanese delegation emphasized the importance of telling the world about the crimes that took place in Sardasht, saying this was the reason for their visit to the town.
I think it is important for the world to get to know about what happened in Sardasht some 30, 40 years ago. So I think it's very important for me to really come visit this place.
The international community has turned a blind eye on this brutal chemical attack in the last 36 years. We can hope such meetings and gatherings can pave the way to raise the voice of the victims of this brutal attack. Farzana Shuryum, Sardasht.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. the supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
In the limelight.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned an economic downturn in the United States cannot be ruled out yet. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned that the economy is still at risk of a recession, while expressing concern over persistently high inflation in the U.S. In an interview with CBS show Face the Nation over the weekend, she said it's appropriate and normal for growth to be low. When asked about a potential recession following the June jobs report, which was the weakest since December 2020, and showed that the U.S. economy was adding fewer jobs than in previous months, Yellen said it's not completely off the table. U.S. inflation has begun to ease. It was still high. After prices rose 4% year over year in May, double the U.S. Federal Reserve's 2% target, the Treasury Secretary noted. For months, the Federal Reserve has attempted to restrain inflation by hiking interest rates to their highest level in decades, slowing economic growth and prompting fears of a recession. Last month, the central bank decided not to raise interest rates further, but signaled that more rate hikes this year were possible, saying last week that a recession in 2023 is quite likely, but probably won't be deep or prolonged. According to Forbes, rising interest rates, high inflation, an inverted yield curve, and an unexpected banking crisis have all been cited as reasons that a recession could be imminent in the United States. The New York Fed recession probability indicator suggests there is a 68.2% chance of a U.S. recession sometime in the next 12 months. That's the highest reading in more than four decades. Other reliable economic indicators are flashing warning signs that the U.S. economy could soon be rolling over. The most recent core personal consumption expenditures price index data showed that this key measure of U.S. inflation was up 4.6% from a year ago. While it's down significantly from peak 2022 levels, core PCE remains well above the Fed's long-term target of 2%. That latter point is why the Fed has raised the federal funds target rate range by 5% since March 2022. But while raising rates can help lower inflation, the higher they go, the more expensive it becomes for U.S. companies to invest in innovation and growth. In addition, higher rates increase the cost of loans for regular Americans. Credit card balances, mortgage loans, and auto loans are more expensive, reducing the disposable income people have to spend, weighing on corporate earnings and stock prices. Analysts are expecting S&P 500 companies to report a 6.3% year-over-year earnings decline in the second quarter, the third consecutive quarter of negative earnings growth. The banking crisis in the U.S. has further tightened credit markets, reducing banks' willingness to lend to corporations and consumers. According to Forbes, one warning sign of a U.S. recession has been flashing for investors since mid-2022. The yield on two-year U.S. Treasury notes jumped above the yields on 10-year Treasury notes, a phenomenon known as a yield curve inversion. Inverted yield curves have historically been a strong economic recession indicator. Historically, two-thirds of the time the yield curve has inverted, the U.S. economy has fallen into a recession within 18 months. The last time the yield curve inverted was in late 2019, just a few months prior to the COVID-19 recession. In early 2023, the yield curve inverted to its deepest level since 1981. CNBC also reported it has been well reported that an economic downturn could be coming to the U.S. But the question is, when might a recession happen and how bad could it be? Many Americans fear an economic downturn could be as bad as the 2007 to 2009 financial crisis, a recent nationwide survey of 2,000 adults has found. To that point, 68% are expecting a recession in the next 6 months, and 80% of those respondents expect it to be severe.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Midstream.
Of fighting against the Jenin battalion of the Al-Quds brigades and the rest of the resistance factions inside the Jenin camp, and far from the tales of the military disappointment that this broader military operation in the West Bank region left behind since 2002, Israel failed to achieve its central goal announced by each of the political echelons to destroy the Jenin battalion. On the other hand, the Palestinian resistance came out of this round stronger with its will, persistence, and position on which the Palestinian public opinion was unanimous, especially as it embodied with its modest capabilities a wonderful example of fighting, military tactics and maneuvers, and field unit among all its fighters, which enabled it to fight the enemy forces and inflict them with losses. After the end of the aggression, Jenin, its city, countryside, and camp mourned the martyrs in a solemn procession amid consensus of the opinion of armed confrontation with the occupation and declaring allegiance to the resistance despite the destruction and devastation caused by the occupation in homes and public and private property during its aggression. On the opposite side, it became clear that the failure of the Israeli ground forces would cast a shadow over the form of confrontation in the coming period, given that these forces suffered heavy losses in ambushes and clashes that took place on more than one block, which prevented them from making any progress in the areas they tried to penetrate. Despite the support of its nearly 1,000 fighters with warplanes and drones that launched more than 20 raids and with more than 200 armored military patrols, Israel was humiliated. It is now expected that this failure will drive the enemy not to repeat the process in the way it took place and thus resort to other methods, most notably relying heavily on air raids, bombing and assassination operations, or through spy agents and special forces. A week of security, intelligence, and military failure experienced by Israel carried with it blows in more than one place and on more than one level, starting with the Jenin camp all the way to the operations that targeted Tel Aviv and the most prominent pillars of the settlement project in the West Bank, without neglecting the northern front with Lebanon. It seems that after the last battle of Jenin will not be the same as before it. The 50 hours of steadfastness and resistance in the alleys of the camp and the streets of the city bore repercussions that were not limited to strengthening the failure of the enemy army in eliminating and uprooting the resistance, but rather to demonstrating a qualitative development in the performance of the resistance in the occupied West Bank, which is heading towards further escalation and momentum. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Perhaps the Battle of Jenin camp will enter history as the moment of qualitative transformation of the accumulations that have continued in the consciousness of the Palestinian people and their struggle. The qualitative shift here is not limited to the fact that Netanyahu, his huge occupation army, and his waning government have failed miserably in achieving their goals of breaking the resistance of the Jenin camp and liquidating the resistance fighters and their popular base, but also in the transformation of the popular incubator of the resistance in the Jenin camp into a general popular Palestinian incubator in all of historic Palestine. To discuss this issue with us from the occupied West Bank is Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate. Thank you very much, Dr. Amal, for being with us, especially at these very intense and interesting times indeed in occupied Palestine and all historic Palestine. Now, the declared goal of the Zionist operation against the Jenin camp was dubbed House and Garden, or House and Backyard, which was supposed to strike a blow at the senior resistance fighters in the Jenin brigades and to supposedly end Jenin's role as a safe haven for
terrorism. This is what the Israelis are saying, and paved the way for the return of the Palestinian Authority, supposedly also to the camp, which Israel has long described this camp as a hornet's nest because it sheltered the resistance fighters. How do you understand the results of the recent Battle of Jenin?
Well, thanks for having me, Dr. Marwa. And Jenin proves again, and the freedom fighters here, the resistance fighters there, proved that cannot be defeated. On the contrary, they fought a very hard lesson, not only to the army and to the security forces, but also to the elite forces that entered the camp, who were witnessing a different sort of tactics, field tactics, and sophisticated, primitive material, but it had been a great results against the Israeli army. One of the commanders of the Divan unit had explained this thoroughly in a letter that he sent to the Minister of War, Yoav Gallant, and expressing his objection actually to attributing this failure on his unit and saying that they are all responsible for this defeat. This is coming from the elite unit of Divan, and this field commander has been experienced with Gaza, fighting with Gaza and the Gaza resistance fighters. So coming from him means a lot. He's a witness from within. He was telling the Minister of War that your intelligence, talking to the minister, your intelligence that we receive about the nature of the fighters in Jenin were absolutely incorrect. No, the information was false. The fighters were diagnosed as having no field experience in battles, and that they are not organized, and that most of them were born after 2002, except their birthdays, of course. Everything was wrong except birthdays of these fighters. Being that the resistance fighters were well-trained, well-prepared, very organized fighters, and appeared out of nowhere. He went on describing the hours that they had on the field fighting ghosts. They come and the snipers come, Palestinian resistance fighters, snipers comes and go, they disappeared. So this explains the real facts on the field. It's not us. Okay, I'm not a military expert. I just read reports and journalist reflection. But this is coming from very sophisticated special forces unit of it.
Well, Dr. Amal, one thing that hit very hard home for the Palestinians, whether inside Palestine or abroad, was the sight and the images of Palestinian families leaving their homes, which shook feelings in a scene that brings to mind the tragedy of Nakba in Palestine, how at least 3,000 people were displaced and thrown out of their homes in Jenin. How did the collective Palestinian conscience deal with such a scene?
Just one more comment about the previous question. Sure. There is no way that Jenin can chop through or sneak up bread, either by the Israelis nor by the Palestinian Authority. The resistance in Jenin becomes a symbol of resistance, a model, not only in the West Bank, but also in the surrounding battlefields in Lebanon and in Syria, in Yemen. So they prove again that they can handle this Israeli occupation, and they can handle the devastation. You know, the Air Force bombed the infrastructure of the camp, And they excavated the roads. They damaged the water facilities and electricity. And they forced, actually, they forced by gun points that against the residents of the camps to get them outside of the camp. 5,000 people left the camp outside, and they were housed by the municipality and other community organizations. But this environment, the environment inside the camp itself, and the environment in Jenin, in the West Bank, all of Palestine, outside of Palestine, they are in support of these resistance fighters. They are in support of Jenin. Just hours or a few hours after the Israelis withdrew from the camp, tons of assistance started pouring into the camp, and people from all over the West Bank and 1948 came into their rescue and to provide assistance and help. So this image of destroying the camp resembles the destroying of the villages. There were 531 villages, Palestinian villages in 1948, were totally leavened with the ground. So this explains to us the mentality, the Zionist mentality, the Zionist movement project, how they worked, how they, it did not go away. It is enforced now with this government, with this ultra extremist government. But on the contrary of 1948, the Palestinians did not escape out of the country. They did not allow the Israelis to achieve their goal. They went back into the camp, and we saw hundreds of youth cleaning the camp, bathing the roads again, electrical powers, you know, being restored immediately, and the water services. So the camp is healing, and it's healing quickly, and it's still giving the fighter the respect and the love that they deserve.
Well, Dr. Amal Wahdan, it's time with you just flies, and I always want to know more, to listen more, to get more information from you, but promise to have you again as soon when you have time to be with us to talk about more about the plight of the Palestinians in general, but about specific stances by the native Palestinians alongside one another and alongside their resistors, freedom fighters as well. Dr. Amal Wahdan, human rights advocate, thank you very much for joining us from the West Bank, the occupied West Bank, to talk about Jenin. Now, please stay tuned, because next we're going to talk about how the Israeli regime utterly failed inside of Jenin.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The Israeli occupation army ended its extensive military aggression operation in the Jenin camp, which some of its commanders called the home and backyard operation, for which it recruited more than 1,000 soldiers led by the most elite commando brigade, while the Israeli Air Force provided air cover to the forces. The ground elite in this process, whose military operations did not reach half a square kilometers, and after 48 hours of fighting against the Jenin battalion of the Al-Quds Brigades and the rest of the resistance factions inside the Jenin camp, it was unable to achieve its central goal announced by each of the political tiers. More details in this following report.
The Israeli occupation army withdrew in the late hours of Tuesday, July 4th from the city of Jenin in the northern occupied West Bank. After fierce resistance and confrontation demonstrated by the Palestinian resistance within the framework of the Jenin Battalion. Over the course of 2 days of aggression, which resulted in the death of 12 Palestinians and the injury of 100 others, including 20 in serious condition, while the Israeli army admitted that one of its soldiers was killed while it was withdrawing. In this context, the occupation army admitted through its spokesperson that the aggression against the city of Jenin and its camp did not achieve the desired goals, claiming that there are no magical solutions to what it called terrorism. The occupation army spokesman announced that the army would return to Jenin in the event that intelligence information was available. Likewise, the former head of the Military Intelligence Service, Tamir Heyman, acknowledged that the operation could not eradicate the military force built by the Islamic Jihad organization in the Jenin camp and the northern West Bank. While the aggression aimed to weaken the Palestinian militants, hit their infrastructure, and allow the army to operate freely, similar to what is happening in the rest of the West Bank cities, Heyman believed that the firing of rockets from Gaza on Tuesday, July 4th, aimed at linking the Jenin-Tel Aviv-Gaza axis. It was clear for the enemy that the recent May operation in Gaza did not deter the Islamic Jihad, and that July 4th rocket fire on Sderot was clear evidence of that, and that the central goal of the process of firing rockets along with Tel Aviv resistance operation is an affirmation of the unity of the arenas in confronting Israel. Hebrew media acknowledged the failure of the occupation army to achieve its desired goals of aggression, pointing out that it is not possible to eradicate the resistance from Jenin in 2 days, describing the operation as a show that it was nothing more than a palliative pill for the settlers. Haaretz newspaper said the army found it difficult to reach all the weapons in the Jenin camp and reduced expectations of the results of the operation. While the newspaper Israel Today described what is happening as a battle on the front in the West Bank and on the home front in Tel Aviv. Observers believe that the mere hint of the occupation leaders to return again to Jenin means that the operation did not achieve its objectives. The Israeli operation has indeed failed to eliminate the hotbed of resistance in the Jenin camp, which has turned into an inspiring model for the Palestinians and for other regions. Despite Israel's mobilization of 1,000 soldiers, more than 200 vehicles, and its use of warplanes for the first time since 2002, the battle reflected a tremendous state of social and field solidarity between the Palestinians in Jenin camp, the city, the countryside, and other Palestinian cities, fully unifying the Palestinian battlefields.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Occupied Al-Quds is Dr. Mohammad Halassi, academic and researcher in Zionist Israeli affairs. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Halassi. Now, the Gaza Strip actually fired rockets at the occupied Palestinian territories, which is controlled by the Zionist entity, at the last minute during the Israeli aggression on Jenin last week. Then we also all watched together the Tel Aviv operation that happened, which was also carried out by a young man from Al-Khalil, Hebron. While the occupation admitted that just only one of its soldiers were killed in the Jenin camp. How do you assess Israel's consecutive unwinnable battles, which so far ending in what we saw in Jenin last week?
In fact, the Israeli aggression was not limited only to this round of confrontations and this storming of the city of Jenin. The Israeli occupation and its successive governments have resorted to the logic of force and used the surplus of force they have, believing that they are capable of breaking the thorn of the Palestinians and ending Palestinian resistance. Israel has not learned its lessons yet. Even the Israeli left, when it assumed power, believed in sticks against the Palestinians, while the right believed in thick sticks. All of them agreed that the continuation of the aggression against the Palestinian society is the means to silence the resistance. After 75 years of this occupation, Israel still has not learned the lesson and has not realized that the use of force does not work with the Palestinian people. This is a people who are not looking for human needs and life demands. This is a people who are looking for emancipation and freedom. Netanyahu went with his government to the city of Jenin, believing that the continuation of the oppression and abuse and conveying the image of the victor by attacking the Palestinian infrastructure. Israel was not able to eliminate the resistance because we realized that the capital of the resistance in Jenin is a group of armed people with simple weapons who move quickly, and stopping them is not an easy matter.
This is what I want to focus a bit on, Mr. Mohammed, because a lot of the Israeli observers right now in Israeli Hebrew media are saying that the Jenin battle will spell the end of Netanyahu's government during the next year because it failed in its various tracks, not only in Jenin but elsewhere as well, especially in Gaza, and also stopping the what they call the lone wolf operations against Tel Aviv, for example, and other occupied territories. What's your take on that specific event?
We agree that the Netanyahu government, which has only been around for 6 months now, is suffering from various crises, one of which is the internal crisis afflicting Israeli society as a result of his government's desire to make judicial amendments. Also, Netanyahu is facing a crisis of his isolation with the outside world. For example, in its confrontation with Iran, we see that the Islamic Republic is expanding and Israel is shrinking. In the relationship with the United States, we see that there is an isolation for Netanyahu, and we have seen the scale of the American reaction and the description that Biden used to describe Netanyahu's government as the most extreme government since the government of Golda Meir. Netanyahu promised that he would go to the West Bank to bring security to the settlers. Security never came to the settlers in the West Bank, and security never came to the settlers inside the occupied Palestinian territories as a result of the series of operations that took place and the Palestinian reactions that took place in retaliation to the brutal incursion into Jenin. The Israeli society keeps burying its head in the sand, even as a society, because society is supposed to be an alive one, as happened, for example, in the French colonization of Algeria and as happened to the American colonization of Vietnam, where a situation was created within the colonial societies that encouraged their forces to leave and return to their countries. For example, Jean-Paul Sartre said, "It is not their violence, but ours that pushed us back." This internal situation has not been born within the Israeli colonial society until this moment to question and hold its successive governments accountable for what they are doing, despite the fact that these societies are paying the price as a result of the reactions that the Palestinians bring to their settlers. Perhaps the totality of what is happening will eventually lead to the collapse of this government and the series of mistakes that this government commits because of its right-wing policies, thus pushing Netanyahu to more foolishness. The noose is tightening around the neck of Netanyahu and his government, and perhaps next year we will see a resurgence of this isolation and these internal crises ravaging the Netanyahu government and shortening its life.
Well, another thing that we observed after or even during the aggression on Jenin was the response by the resistance, which created a strong Palestinian nationalism. It created some sort of a feeling which might just suggest a possible increase in upcoming commando resistance operations against the Israeli entity, especially in the interior occupied territories. We might also see more settlers storming villages, Palestinian villages, burning villages, the likes that we saw in Hawara and Tormosaya as well. But will the Zionist regime be able to withstand a new wave of resistance, especially after the Battle of Jenin?
Once again, the problem is that the Israeli believes that through this racist right-wing government, they can raise the level of challenge with the Palestinian people and raise the level of threat against the Palestinian people. Israel believed that the Palestinian people will decrease their resistance and reduce their reaction with such an aggression on Jenin. The Palestinian reaction was the opposite of what the Israeli leadership wanted, and the reaction increased the resistance of the Palestinian people and broad popular support. Perhaps one of the important messages that we have to read well and that the Israeli society turns a blind eye to is that the popular incubator and the organizational, factional, and even the official support of the Palestinians behind the resistance factions in the city of Jenin has increased with some of this process. In other words, the Jenin offensive did not produce the results that Netanyahu wanted by destroying the infrastructure and turning the popular incubator against the resistance. What happened was exactly the opposite of what the Israeli leadership wanted. Then Netanyahu went to Jenin because he wanted to cool down the arena in Jenin and did not want to inflame other arenas. However, what happened was, as we saw, the resistance fighter who left Al-Khalil Hebron and carried out a heroic operation in Tel Aviv and the rest of the West Bank cities were also likely to fall into more retaliation maneuvers. Netanyahu now realizes that the Palestinian and Arab arenas are interconnected and that they are all one unit. If a member complains in Jenin, the rest of the other resistance arenas will react.
Definitely. This was not a surprise at all, and we continue to see this all across the Palestinian historic map, and we just look forward to what kind of a new wave of resistance the Palestinian natives are putting forth for the Zionist occupation to see. I want to thank you very much from Occupied Al-Quds, Dr. Mohammad Halasi, academic and researcher in Zionist Israeli affairs. Thank you very much for being with
us.
You. Ladies and gents, thank you for being with us. Assalamu alaikum.
In the limelight.
In the United States, the Justice Department has reversed its position on defending Donald Trump in a lawsuit brought by writer E. Jean Carroll, paving the way for a possible trial in January. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The Justice Department on Tuesday, 11th of July, reversed its position that former President Donald Trump was shielded from a 2019 defamation lawsuit filed by the writer E. Jean Carroll. The government had originally argued that Donald Trump was protected from liability by the Westfall Act because he was acting as a federal employee. Under the Act, federal employees are entitled to absolute immunity from personal lawsuits by conduct occurring within the scope of their employment. Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General Brian Boynton wrote in a letter on Tuesday, 11th of July, to attorneys for Donald Trump and E. Jean Carroll that a jury's determination in a separate civil lawsuit that Donald Trump was liable for sexual abuse and defamation of Carroll factored into the decision. That lawsuit was filed in November of 2022 and involved statements that Donald Trump made after his presidency. The allegations that prompted the statements related to a purely personal incident and alleged sexual assault that occurred decades prior to Donald Trump's presidency, Boynton wrote. That sexual assault was obviously not job-related. Writer E. Jean Carroll filed her first lawsuit in 2019 while Donald Trump was still president, and after he accused her of totally lying when she said he sexually assaulted her in a high-end New York City department store in the 1990s. In October 2021, a federal judge in New York ruled that Donald Trump was not shielded from E. Jean Carroll's lawsuit. In 2022, the Second Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals reversed the lower court's decision and suggested the Westfall Act could protect Donald Trump from liability in the case. The lawsuit has remained active and has yet to go to trial. After the jury found that Donald Trump liable in April, E. Jean Carroll amended the lawsuit, adding a new defamation claims relating to more recent statements made by Donald Trump, and he filed a countersuit. The Justice Department had initially argued that even though the former president made cruel and offensive comments in response to a very serious accusation of sexual assault, the law protecting employees like the president from such a lawsuit should be upheld. But the Justice Department reviewed that decision after the jury in E. Jean Carroll's second lawsuit in New York found Donald Trump liable for sexual abuse and defamation. Boynton wrote, "It concluded that Donald Trump had not acted out of desire to serve the government when he denied her claim." Boynton also cited statements that Donald Trump has made about E. Jean Carroll in the years since his presidency ended. These post-presidency statements, which were not before the department during the original scope certification in this case, tend to undermine the claim that the former president made very similar statements at issue in E. Jean Carroll out of a desire to serve the government, Boynton wrote.